we made Airtable into an extra colorful product. The colors were embedded into the functionality, like the rich field types, like the colorful drop downs. Like, we use that to really visually show, like, this is different from what you get.
That's Howie Liu, best known as the founder of Airtable, the platform that made databases feel like apps that anybody could use. Long before product-led growth became a buzzword, Howie and his co-founders poured themselves into creating a product so intuitive and distinct that users didn't ask what's different about this. They just felt the magic instantly and wanted to share it with others. This is Mike Maples Jr. of Floodgate, and it's go time with Howie Liu. This is Mike Maples Jr., and welcome to the Pattern Breakers podcast, where we explore why some founders radically change the future and how they stand apart. Together, we'll learn about the counterintuitive mindsets and actions behind their remarkable success. Brace yourself for a world where chaos is welcome, naysayers are often a positive signal, and movements galvanize misfits who transform the impossible to the inevitable. Beneath the surface of the simple and highly intuitive Airtable user experience was a deeper insight. Spreadsheets were originally designed for finance people. Yet millions of people now were tweaking them in thousands of different ways to do just about everything else, from project management to content calendars to recipes, even travel itineraries. So Howie Liu and his co-founders spent 2 years designing a product that made the transition from a spreadsheet to a hybrid database feel obviously valuable in less than 30 seconds. And it worked. In the crowded world, especially now in this AI era, where every new product fights for attention, showing your insight, your real difference with real product, and quickly, has become vital for achieving breakthrough success. If you want to stand alone, it helps if your difference is viscerally felt instantly. Let's talk to him.
Howie Liu, welcome to the podcast.
Excited to be here.
You know, Airtable wasn't your first rodeo. Why don't we start there? Let's start before the beginning. You know, how did you get into startups? And, what did you learn from your early startup experiences leading up to Airtable?
I mean, I think I just always really loved computers, the internet, like the idea of like, wow, like there's just so much out there that, and anyone could go and participate, right? Like, you know, the fan sites at the time was into like Pokemon and so on. And like anyone could go and make stuff and like put it out there and even like, you know, monetize it. Like I built like a first website, I think in junior high or so, learned HTML. And like, I mean, it was a silly like fan site probably for Pokemon. I just remember those early experiences feeling so empowering that like, you know, here I was, I didn't have like a ton of resources, didn't have capital. And yeah, I could create something of value. And like, it just, all you needed was an idea and time. And like, I had both of those. And then fast forward into like, you know, high school, college, taught myself how to do real programming, you know, 05 through like 2009. That's when I was in college. And I would call that kind of the maybe like, either right before Web 2.0 or right in the like early innings of Web 2.0. And it just felt very exciting because like there, you know, was like a new form of product value that you could create with like an emerging technology. And like at that point, I was like, okay, I think I'm going to learn the skills to go and build value like this. I have the time still and sweat, like still no capital. But then the bottleneck became like finding a good idea, right? And turns out when you're in college, like, you know, most of the problems that are proximal to you are college student problems, right? Like, how do I find a sublet? How do I find roommates? And like, in hindsight, like, these were like fairly small problems. And so I think early on in this journey, I kind of realized like a big part of, you know, entrepreneurship has to be like finding a good problem to work on that's like worthy of like your time and frankly, like the employees or VCs that you'll eventually attract. It wasn't until after I graduated that I landed on the first problem that I kind of felt was actually worthy of going full time on. And that was the idea for eTax, contacts with an E. And it was basically like a CRM-like product that would pull in your emails. And we even like built a scraper for AT&T and Verizon and T-Mobile to like grab your like phone calls and text history and automatically show you this kind of evergreen dashboard of everyone you had talked to. So if, you know, if you're a VC, for instance, you could say like, oh, like when's that last time I caught up with so-and-so entrepreneur, or like, what are my notes from the last time we talked? You know, that felt like a big enough problem and something that like I had experienced firsthand moving out to the Bay Area and like interning briefly at a, you know, a different tech startup, like seeing firsthand, like maybe there's a need for professionals to have a tool like that.
Okay. You got eTax off the ground. How'd it go?
Yeah, well, so I teamed up with a college friend of mine, Evan, and I mean, I went to Duke. I graduated in 2009. I teamed up with like one of the literal handful, like I could count on one hand, I think, the number of nerdy types that I encountered in school who like also read TechCrunch and cared about like, you know, this like whole web startup thing. We applied to YC fairly early on because, you know, I discovered YC from a few years prior, like got the callback, got the interview. And before literally going through that process, like, you know, YC was a website to me. It was like something that I had seen from afar, like on the internet, but like this made it feel real and made the kind of path of like doing a startup of our own feel real for the first time.
So then you kept playing through on eTax. What was the resolution of eTax before you kind of decided to start Airtable?
Yeah, I mean, it felt like a lifetime, but the whole company existed only for a year and a day. You know, we launched the product, we got some early traction. You know, I think we were in a really interesting space pretty early on, got some like, you know, calls from different companies that were, you know, interested in either acquiring us or acqui-hiring us. And so got some different like, you know, knocks on the door. And at some point we just kind of realized like, okay, like we could go this alone. And I do think there's, you know, an independent path to this company, still had funding. We had hired a very small team. But also my co-founder and I basically had the humility to recognize like there's so much we don't know, and we could try to learn it like through trial and error on our own, or we can go and, you know, learn at a different company. And then the second time around, like we'll each do our own next companies at some point, maybe together, maybe separately, ended up being separately. But like we'll have so much more, you know, kind of experience and acumen to do it differently the next time around, right? And maybe pick a different space, right? And so, you know, eventually we decided to go down that path, entertained a few different possible suitors, ended up picking Salesforce partly because I really respected Salesforce as a company that like clearly had done something right in enterprise and SaaS, which like at that time, like Salesforce was kind of the only like notable SaaS company, right?
And did you, I'm curious, like one thing I've seen with some folks is their company will get acquired and it's like they're in purgatory until they can do their next thing. But I've also seen some people say, hey, being a big company is not for me, but there's a few things I really learned. I'm curious about Salesforce in that regard.
I really felt, I mean, so the reason why we picked Salesforce and I was personally excited to go there as opposed to, let's say, a consumer tech company is I always felt like consumer tech, like if you look at the great consumer tech companies, most of them were founded by somebody who did not work in the last consumer tech company, right? Like Larry and Sergey didn't work at Yahoo. Neither did Jerry Yang work at whatever precursed Yahoo, right? You know, and every consumer tech company, it's like you almost are, you know, at least the history would imply that like you're better off like inventing from a fresh canvas than like working within a bigger company and kind of learning their ways. I literally like thought like, not only are they paying us to come in, I would actually pay them to get to go in and learn about this world, right? That was previously very foreign to me. And I think something about SaaS appealed to me because it felt like a more deterministic area to build some value in. Like consumer tech, it kind of feels like a little bit of like a flip of the coin, right? Like, is your thing, is Vine going to be the next, you know, Snap or not, right? It's TikTok, you know. And I like the fact that in like SaaS, it felt like, okay, you pick like a really good problem space and you solve it. There's not a guarantee, but there's a much more predictable path to creating like a big business that way. So that concept really appealed to me. Salesforce, you know, was the really like SaaS titan, SaaS pioneer. Especially at that time, I went out of my way to like do a good enough job and like kind of do interesting enough things there to like kind of get noticed and get to spend time with lots of people throughout the company and learn from them.
So then the idea for Airtable then, I'm curious about kind of the moment of conception of the idea. You know, did it just occur to you in a flash, or did it, how were you visited by the muse with Airtable?
It kind of came to me as a convergence of, one, like the power I saw of the Salesforce platform. And so recognizing that, like, you know, Salesforce had become a giant, even at that time, like, you know, it was at $2 billion in revenue. At that time, I was like, wow, this company has reached incredible scale. And the reason why I ascribe to it is, like, it's not just that they built like a web-based CRM. It's actually that CRM is really an app platform and a database underneath it, masquerading as a, you know, kind of just like a CRM product. But the fact that it's completely configurable means that, like, you're not selling one hard-coded, brittle piece of software. You're actually solving, you know, many different problems. Like, any customer can configure their CRM instance, or even like use at that time, like, they were really pushing hard on the platform itself, like Force.com, for non-CRM use cases. But many, many, if not most, B2B apps can be distilled down into like these different app constructs. Like, you have a relational database, you have like a logic layer, and you have an interface layer. And a product, whether it's Salesforce or before that, Microsoft Access, Lotus Notes, FileMaker Pro, et cetera, if you can deliver on that like kind of app platform form factor, you can solve for a really wide range of B2B app use cases, right? And there's a really large TAM to be won. I had also just read Innovator's Dilemma at that time. And like, I was like, oh, this is like classic, like, opportunity for, you know, me to just come in and build what I know best, which is like, you know, I'm never going to beat, you know, an enterprise company at the game of like going top down and doing sales. But I think I could build like a more modern, more easy to use product that kind of initially almost looks like a toy, relatively speaking, and comes in below the current competitors, right? Like, I'm not going to compete against Salesforce. I'm going to come in with a product that looks like almost like a consumer type of product like Dropbox did. And like, I strongly believe that the best companies are built not only when there's a great problem space and like kind of a great product market fit opportunity, but like, there also has to be passion and skill set fit. And so for me, like, I had a passion for like product UX. And like, I thought, you know, I think I had cultivated a skill set of being able to build modern web-based collaborative products. And so I also felt like it was a good way to exercise like the thing I was passionate at, like, versus, I don't think I could have gotten passionate at like building, let's say, like a top-down sold like EMR system for, you know, health tech.
Yeah,
right?
Lobbying the government to
exactly, yeah,
business profits. Yeah,
totally.
So you got started on the Airtable idea, and it sounds like you kind of had a relationship to this topic, right? You'd been at Salesforce and seen the power of being a system of record. You had all these apps that were kind of at the edge that kind of were doing simple things with databases. And I remember this because I remember trying to use them. But you just, I guess, a bunch of things came together to cause you to think that you could do a cloud native version of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's like kind of like moments in time where an opportunity opens up, right? And in this case, like, I remember doing some like early research on the space and finding actually that like Microsoft Access was still a pretty large product, even though it basically had fallen by the wayside and like Microsoft didn't really care about it. But it was like still generating a fair amount of revenue as kind of this like weird second tier product in their suite, as was FileMaker Pro. Like, FileMaker actually was a product of Claris, which actually was a subsidiary of Apple, but like Apple literally didn't care about it, right? Like, but like, I went and talked to a lot of people who were like working on these products and kind of came to the conclusion that like, there's real market pool still for this type of product, but for like more accidental than like actual market or strategic reasons, they'd all fallen by the wayside and left an opening for somebody, i.e. me, to come in and build like a more modern and web-based, like making the bet on like, okay, we're going to go all in and making this web-based instead of trying to build like a desktop client version of it, right? Because we could have built what was Sketch to Figma, but like, we chose to go all in on the web that here, which I think was the right thing. The product made sense. There could be a version of it that would be even more accessible than the predecessors, because like, it was kind of a pain to install Microsoft Access even, right? You had to like literally install it onto your desktop. And if you wanted to share a database with anyone else, you had to install Microsoft Access on their computers as well, and then create a networked share drive, with a shared file representing the database to collaborate on it, right? It's crazy. Whereas obviously with web, like you could just have a much more instantly collaborative experience and like set up a database in like minutes, not like hours. So I just felt like the moment was right. And like there was a there that gave us some confidence to say like, we're not building something that the world might not need. The world clearly already needs this. And the current forms of it suck.
What was your thought process there? Why did you decide to take, I think it was 2 years, right, to ship your first product?
Yeah, over 2 years.
So, what's up with that? What were you thinking?
I think there's like, I mean, look, there's multiple ways to get to product market fit. And I mean, I think the lean startup way is a valid one, right? And great companies have been built that way, like Twitter. I think like you can either just like shoot a bunch of darts at the board and see what sticks and then kind of iterate from there. I'm not going to like try to premeditate like the perfect thing. I'm just going to go and try a bunch of stuff and then lean into what I discover empirically from that. I think the second approach though is like, I mean, there are good precedents for this as well. Like you think about Tesla, you think about SpaceX, like these are not companies that you could like lean startup your way into, right? Like you had to have like a plan and you're solving like a really hard problem. But like, you know that if you can solve it, there's a big payoff at the end. There is surely a market for like, you know, scalable, cost-efficient space shuttles, right? Or launches, right? As there is for an electric car that's actually performant and efficient. The real question is more like, how do you get there? And can you like find a technological path to get there without dying, right? And so I think that latter path just always appealed to my style a little bit more. Like, even like what we were talking about before and why B2B to me was always a little bit more interesting than consumer. Like I wanted to build something that had like a real craft and quality to it. So I wanted like consumer grade UX, but applied to like a known problem that if I could just figure out how to solve from a technological standpoint, there's a clear market for, right? And so, you know, like the 2.5 years we spent, first of all, that wasn't like 2.5 years in a vacuum. We first started with what we thought was the most important part to de-risk. So like, there's no point in building a complicated real-time, like, you know, kind of database engine and like the whole backend infrastructure for this if we can't actually make the product and the UX intuitive enough to get people to just start adopting it without reading a manual, right? Like we had to make the actual product good and we had to make it good on the web. And at that time, like there really was a question of like, can you create a rich enough product experience purely like in the browser, right?
So I'm super curious about this, right? Because I remember when you guys launched on Hacker News, I remember reading about you guys in the early days. There were two things that I remember that really jumped out at me. One was this idea that says, okay, we have to make it easy to use for non-programmers. How did you think about iterating? Like, how do you iterate when you don't have users explicitly? And how do you learn from iterations without being in the market?
Yeah, so we did try to get real user feedback even before we officially launched the product. So meaning like the first version of Airtable was actually like a front-end only prototype that basically completely faked the backend or the persistence layer. And the goal was not to actually get people to like put real data, real workflows into the product, but it was good enough that we could shop around. I mean, honestly, mostly to friends and family, but we tried to pick like friends and family or, you know, kind of people in our network who had intentionally diverse workflows. So here's a person who works in BD at Walmart. Here's a person who works in VC, right? Like, and see how would you manage your pipeline, you know, in this prototype, right? And like, you know, basically ask them as a favor to sit with us for like an hour, 2 hours and like show us how they could use this product, even though they couldn't actually use it steady state. And then, you know, getting some validation from that, like we built like a really hacky persistence layer. And then eventually we built like a proper backend persistence layer. But every step of the way, we tried to cut all the corners we could. Like we didn't actually ship like the real-time collaborative version of Airtable until the very end. We thought that would be a very important key capability and that, you know, betting on like having that real-time collaborative architecture would be a long-term winning, you know, kind of a strategy. But like it was a lot of technical effort to put, you know, to work on upfront, unless we had already vetted like, okay, every single other part of this product is working and makes sense. Okay, now we're going to solve the heavy lift of making it all real time, right? So It was kind of like a steady progression of like getting more usage validation at different stages, even if it was only like a small handful of people. There was actually one friend. He worked at a friend's company, and I remember like we got him to use Airtable for his I think it was like a partnerships workflow. He was a BD person at a startup, and like at one point the product just wiped all his data. It like lost all his data because it wasn't a proper persistence layer. And he was like pretty frustrated because like he had put all this work into it and it just all disappeared. And we felt really bad, sent him like, I think, a very nice bottle of whiskey. But like, you know, it's like those were still shortcuts that I think were worth taking because otherwise we wouldn't have gotten any feedback until like the very final reveal moment, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting. One of the things I've talked to some people about before is this idea of implementation prototypes. And so, like a lot of the great products I've seen, they demonstrate in the software itself the fundamental insight behind the product, right? So, like, you know, I remember the first time I ever saw a Figma workspace and a bunch of cursors come into it all at the same time, or the first time you ever saw like 8 lines of code for Stripe. There was a way that you could show what was different about it in a 30-second window of time, and you couldn't unsee it, right? And what I learned is that for many products, you don't have to have the actual product to deliver that, right? So it's a little bit like in car shows. Sometimes they have a car, but it doesn't really have an engine in it. And if you turn on the radio, it's a concept car, right? And so, like, one of the things that I started to notice with a lot of the startups that I worked with that it had success is they would do these kind of concept car demo implementation prototypes. And what they were really trying to do was show enough tangible reality to tease out desperation. They'd say, "Hey, I'm going to show this to you. It's not completely done, but like what jumps out at you when I see it, when you see it?" And you knew you were on the right track if their pupils dilate and they say, "When are you going to build this and how soon can I have it?" Whereas if it wasn't just an obvious ring the bell situation, it's like, okay, we still haven't found it yet. How did you use the fact that you were kind of UI focused at first to tease out surprises where they were more desperate than you thought, or things that you thought they'd like, they didn't like?
I mean, in a sense, the prototypes we had were the car without the engine, right? I mean, literally, it didn't have the back end, but it had like all the semblance of working. And so I think we were testing for a few things. One is like, is the UX intuitive enough for people to just kind of pick up and start using? Because I think if there was too much friction to figure out how to use a product, we just believed it would fail because we knew intuitively that this would have to be a PLG product, right? And then second of all, I think like to your point, even just being easy enough to use is not enough. Like, it has to be compelling enough that, like, you know, you can lower the friction to adoption to nil, but like people still have to have a reason to try out this new thing. It's not like a consumer social app where like they're going to try it just for novelty's sake. And so, what is the utility that we can provide them on, you know, above and beyond the status quo, which for most people was basically Google Sheets, right? Or Excel. Like, you know, most people are not using Access or FileMaker today. They're actually using a spreadsheet for non-financial workflows. So, you know, they're creating their CRM list in a spreadsheet. They're creating like an inventory list in a spreadsheet or the recruiting list, et cetera. And so, could we show enough compelling value in an actual interactive prototype that people would get excited about doing that workflow in Airtable as opposed to the status quo, right? And so, to your point, like we really tried to front load as many of these like sizzly features as we could versus like more what I would call like subtle ones. And some of them were like, one, just the ability to attach files into the product or have like colorful, rich field types. Whereas, especially at the time, Google Sheets was like very bare bones. It was like text and numbers, everything was black and white. And now here's Airtable. You have like the option to have colorful checkboxes and drop downs and like an attachment.
You could just tell it was different, right? You knew,
It
just
was
knew it was
immediate. It's
different.
like, yeah.
Yeah.
And we actually even played that up with the colors and like kind of the visual aesthetic. Like we made Airtable into an extra colorful product to really differentiate. And it wasn't just superfluous colors. It was like, you know, the colors were embedded into the functionality, like the rich field types, like the colorful drop downs. Like we used that to really visually show like this is different from what you get.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of lessons in that. Some of the startups I've seen, they make a really compelling product. They take all this risk, but when it comes time to describe how they want to show up in the world, they kind of flinch. They use what I call comparison language. You know, we're a better CRM. the other approach I like to call a reframe, where you're saying, I reject the premise of the current way of doing things. And one of the ways that you reframe is not just in how you describe it, but in how the product shows up, how it works, like all the cursors in the Figma, you know, design as multiplayer rather than single player, file versions, handoff, hope for the best kind of stuff.
I consider myself still, like, my primary competency is like being a product designer, product UX thinker. To me, like, UX is the product in many cases, if not most cases, of products, right? Like, the form factor and like how people see it and use it and intuit how to use it, that is literally the product, right? Like, you could have all the complicated back-end technology you want, but like, if it doesn't show up in a immediate and visceral way for the user, like, it's all moot, right? And so, you know, this is actually relevant as well to like building AI products. Using visual metaphors to really show the customer what's going on and like play up magical things or capabilities is so important, right? Like, I mean, and in the world of AI, it's like, these models are incredibly potent. And yet, like, it's kind of belied by the fact that like the default interface for it is like a blinking cursor in a chat box. Like, it doesn't really show like the magic of what's happening behind the scenes and all the different diverse use cases you could have for it. And so I really believe in giving visual metaphor to what is actually happening from a technology and like magical capability standpoint to the user. And I mean, that's like the entire reason why personal computing took off, right? Like, the GUI was what unlocked the power of computers for a mainstream audience. And you could call that all visual like metaphor, just, you know, kind of a cosmetic layer, but like, it is everything to making computing accessible.
Yeah, exactly. So then I'm wondering, you know, you ended up having a fairly horizontal product, like, but I'm just wondering, did you have any type of segmentation strategy or any definition of a niche in the early days that you were targeting?
Yeah. So first of all, like, every person we talked to in those early days recommended against pursuing a horizontal product, right? And we did just want to build a horizontal product, partly because we wanted to build a horizontal product, right? Like, I don't think I would have been as personally excited about building any one vertical solution product. Now, to your point, I think, like, you know, we did recognize even before launch that it would be really hard to be all things to all people. So how do we carve off at least some subset of use cases that would work really well for Airtable? One, we knew that we would focus on smaller scale use cases early on, right? So one dimension was like, we're not trying to support like a 5,000 person, like, kind of workflow. We're going to support like 1 to 5 person team use cases, right? And maybe that's a small business. Maybe it's a small team within a bigger company. Most of these workflows are going to exist in their current form in a spreadsheet, right? So there's also like a clean, direct metaphor for people to cross over from. And like, I think like one of the reasons why Airtable defied that conventional wisdom of like, don't go horizontal, pick like some ICPs, pick some jobs to be done, is that like, we were actually able to get people who were doing something in a spreadsheet to come over and with relatively little effort, just port that workflow into Airtable. And we put a lot of effort into like, making a lot of the same behaviors of a spreadsheet work in Airtable. Like, you could copy paste, you could, like, you know, click and drag an entire column at a time, or, you know, do multi-select over like a large range of cells. A lot of just what worked in a spreadsheet, we were able to like give people the like instant familiarity of making it also work in Airtable. And then finally, like, we pretty quickly did build templates into the product. I don't think we had them when we did the Hacker News launch. I think between then and when we did our full GA launch, we did end up building some templates, and we would continue to go and like invest into more templates, which were kind of like a very lightweight way of showing people what they could do with the product and almost creating like apps or solutions on the platform that people could start with.
Yeah. And I guess that was probably part of the how you got people hooked, right? They come into Airtable and it's like, there's already a list of bases. It's like you know, it's not like people don't know where to begin. It's like, hopefully one of those bases will attract the imagination, if nothing else, right?
I mean, it sounds funny to say in hindsight, but like, the first version of Airtable that launched, including the Hacker News launch, like, literally you would sign up for Airtable and you just have a blank screen. Like, you'd have a home screen with like, here's your first workspace. You had to create your first base, like your first app in Airtable, like by clicking add base. You know, you then had to like, you just got a blank table where like I don't even think we had any columns or rows. It looked weird. It was like a zero column, zero row table, and you had to build everything from scratch. And like it became very obvious to us very quickly that like, pre-installing a few templates into somebody's workspace, right? So like the first thing you see is like, here's five pre-built templates that even if they're not exactly what you want, inspire you, show you what the product actually looks like when it's filled with some data and structure. And then second of all, like even when you go and create a new table, we're never going to just give you like zero rows, zero columns. We're going to like fill it in with like a few example columns and example rows to just show you what you can do in the product. Like those were like very small things that actually made a huge difference in the adoption rate of the product because like, again, in hindsight, it's obvious, but like, people coming in were like, this is like literally like a blank canvas. Like it's completely blank, and I have no idea what I'm supposed to do with it.
So we haven't talked much about your sort of co-founding relationships. How did you guys decide to come together? And what were your respective superpowers? And what worked well and what didn't work so well?
Yeah, maybe like any other really significant life relationship. Co-founding a company, it's like a very significant choice, right? You're going to be spending a lot of time with this person. You better like them. In addition to finding complementary strengths and be able to be a good team, like you better actually just like them as a person, right? Because you're going to be spending a lot of time together. And if that's not fun, but so both my first co-founder with eTax, Evan, as well as my two co-founders with Airtable, who are Andrew and Emmett, respectively, both still with the company. They were all actually three people I knew from college who, there was like almost like this naturalness to ending up, working with all of them on respective companies. Andrew, actually, I was roommates with when I first moved out to San Francisco and had at different points tried to like, get him to team up with me on a different, on a company or join eTax, for instance, when we were working on that. At the time he had just taken a job at Google as an APM. It was like a very coveted job. Marissa Meyer was still the person running it. And like I think at that time, with my first startup, he was looking at like, okay, well, I have an amazing job. We just got taken around the world on this cool world tour trip. We get all the perks, and we get to work on really awesome products that have like hundreds of millions of users. Or I could go work with you on this like tiny startup and you're eating burritos all day and sleeping on air mattresses and in the office. Like, I think I'm gonna learn a couple things at Google for a little longer. And so credit to him. Like, I think I think he made a smart choice for, what he wanted to do at the time. And then later after that experience, I think he was ready to make the jump. And so, it like he was like quite literally the first person I made the call to when I started thinking about Airtable. We teamed up. In a way, like I think we actually had like overlapping strengths, which was actually good and somewhat intentional because we were both able to think very much about the product and the UX, which like we could build off of each other. And then, from an actual execution standpoint, I think I had learned like more on the B2B side from my Salesforce experience, like had more full stack development experience. So we ended up like finding, a very fluid way to complement each other's roles, like literally in terms of execution. I would start working more on the back end at some point, even though we both cared a lot about the front end, the product UX. We just kind of ended up at every point finding a way to complement each other really well. And then Emmett came on a little later, but as our third co-founder, also somebody who we knew very well, wanted to work with. And he kind of became like the true CTO of the company. And he also had very strong product sensibility. So I think in a way we all three stacked up on like the product, sense. But then, he would take on even more of like the back end, like technical architecture responsibilities. And I think as we evolved as a company, like I would actually say that like having a co-founding team that all really cared about like the product UX actually was a strength rather than a weakness, over time.
So that in terms of product market fit then for you guys, some companies it hits like a lightning strike and some companies it's more like a gradient. What like was it clear pretty early on that you had product market fit, or was it more just like you're working like crazy every day, and one day you look back on it and you realize you had it?
It was more of the gradient, but the good news for us was like there was a very steady trend in the right direction, right? Like I also really believe in qualitative feedback being very important. Like we feel very confident that there is a need for this product. If we build it the right way, we will also have a little bit of a moat or a significant moat because, you know, other companies can't just go and build this product overnight, right? Big companies or small companies. Like, it's a hard product to get right. And as long as we're marching on the right path and getting more and more signals that, like, we're onto something, the customers who are using it love it. You know, we like one of our pre-official launch customers were actually getting all of their data and workflows into Airtable was a nonprofit that basically they had considered using Salesforce that would have been really expensive to implement and also extremely slow and clunky for their particular needs. And it was everything from like program management to donor tracking to like volunteer management and all of these kind of like, you know, kind of not quite down the middle CRM use cases. And for them, they were actually begging to use Airtable. They were saying like, we need this product because we want to build it ourselves. And our next best option would be spreadsheets, but that's way too like flimsy and it's going to be all messy. So we literally need this product. And so we would get these like very validating anecdotal stories early on. And then once we launched, we saw like a, what I would call like a steady and kind of moderate pace of compounding growth. Like, you know, if we got a launch spike of like maybe tens of thousands in the first week of our full GA launch, then it kind of came back down to like, you know, call it like many dozens of signups per day organically. But at least there was like a stable trend there where it wasn't dissipating to zero. It was stable. And then it started growing and growing and growing, right? So maybe like a few months later, it was like more than that. It was 100 signups per day, right? And then beyond that, it was hundreds. And so I think we just saw like a good trend there, which now I think back on and I think like the whole point of the NPS score is that it predicts how organically viral a product is. Not because you built like some like cheesy viral, like spammy things into the product where you're encouraging people to like spam their friends, but because like the product is actually so exciting and delightful to the person that they, I mean, literally the question of NPS is like, how much are you likely to refer this to a friend or family, right? And so if you answer yes, because it's such a delightful product, like it's gonna have natural organic virality because the market needs something like this and people love it and are willing to talk about it.
Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting, you know, there are companies kind of in your cohort who probably on some level AI feels like a threat. What happens if the AI guys do to you what you did to some of the, you know, early internet or even desktop native companies? But it seems like you've embraced it pretty aggressively, kind of like Aaron over at Box and folks like that. When did you first have sort of your aha about it? And how have you been thinking about it in terms of, you know, opportunities and threats?
From a technology standpoint, I've always been like very intrigued by AI. And like in college, I did some like projects with neural networks. I like, you know, built my own implementation of like the Netflix Data Science Prize competition, where you were trying to predict like better recommendations for movies off this large data set. But this was like very early and primitive stuff, right? I mean, we're talking very like very small neural networks. They couldn't do anything nearly as advanced as like the modern Gen AI models, right? And long before even the breakthrough of like ImageNet, which kind of set off the spark of like the modern excitement and kind of like rapid progress in AI. But I've always kind of been interested in it as a technology concept. And I actually remember making a distinct choice at the time graduating college, like, oh man, I really love this like, you know, kind of machine learning thing, but like, I think its applications are too narrow to be really interesting to me at the time. And like, I think right now, like it'd be much more interesting to like go and do something that's more like product and UX centric, right? Which is what I did. And so like, for me, the real tipping point was, I think with Gen AI, you know, AI got to the point where like, it actually was, you know, kind of really changing the product UX of products, right? I mean, you think about ChatGPT, it's not just like a backend, like, you know, predictive analytics, you know, type of ML implementation. Like, it's something that changes how people interact with software, period, right? There's this Bill Gates quote recently of like, you know, him saying, there's only been two truly astounding technologies I've seen in my entire lifetime. And the first was the GUI that he saw at Xerox PARC. And the second is basically ChatGPT, right? And like, really, like, the magical and very like accessible experience of anyone can go in and talk to this AI, and it's really smart and it can do a wide range of things. And so I think I've been like very, very excited as, you know, both a user of and kind of like avid AI tourist of every new AI product, you know, that has come out over the recent past, but also like really trying to think about like how this new capability, similar to how web tech enabled a new product UX and new form factors, like what does AI mean for the form factor of products, including Airtable? And I think the only way to properly ask that question is not to start with what you have and say like, okay, how do I throw some AI on top of it? But like instead, if you were to say Airtable does not exist in the world, there is no Airtable. And instead, like I have to design a clean slate solution to what does the world need for this category of like app building, right? And I strongly believe like, you know, app building would become more, not less relevant in the AI era. Like you need a container to represent data and workflows, both, you know, AI and human workflows together in like a self-contained unit. And that app needs to be much more fluid than the apps that you saw in the prior generation of enterprise software, right? Like, because you can agentically build and evolve those apps, right? And so, like, what is the ideal app form factor in the future? And okay, now, like, how do we look at what we have and compare the delta of that to, you know, where we need to go and almost see our current product as a parts bin to disassemble and reassemble into, like, the right experience to get there, right? And there are glimmers of like what the next form factor will be in the form of like these vibe coding products. You know, you go and like you agentically build an app in Cursor or a Lovable or a V0, et cetera. And it's quite magical, right? And right now it's primarily useful for just prototyping, or if you're a developer, you can inspect the code that it generates and actually make it into production ready apps. But like, you know, there's clearly like a magical new UX unlocked by you know, basically agents that have gotten smart enough to do more advanced app building, whereas like the first generation of it was much more simple, like few lines at a time, autocomplete, right? In the original kind of like code complete or Copilot autocomplete model. And so I think it's just really important to like A, have market awareness, and like B, a very prolific user of all of the new products, not just because you want to stay competitively aware, but also because like that informs your mental model of like a new form factor, maybe akin to seeing the GUI for the first time. And then two, like you have to think creatively about like how do these new capabilities and new design patterns apply to our category? Like we're not going to sit around and wait for somebody to like literally build what should exist. But instead, we're going to look at products that don't seem directly competitive to us. Like Cursor is not a direct competitor to Airtable, right? Neither is like V0 or Lovable, et cetera. Like, again, they're used for very different use cases. You can't build reliable B2B apps with those products. But yet, like, I take more inspiration from what they're doing and the experience of using those products than I do maybe from like more classic competition in our category.
Well, cool. So I'm curious, what should I have asked you that I haven't so far? Maybe through the lens of what you think founders could learn from your journey.
The biggest mistakes I've made, and I don't have many regrets. Like I think even when I've made mistakes, like I've tried to look at them as learning experiences. You know, I've made mishires, right? Or, you know, I wish I had not, you know, shifted my attention so much to enterprise go-to-market execution for, you know, kind of a certain window of the company, and instead like continued to always put my energy and my skill set towards new product innovation throughout. There are many of these mistakes. The biggest kind of meta lesson though is like trust, you know, your own instincts. And I feel like if I could sum up like every mistake I've made or kind of find the common theme behind them, it's that I usually was trying to do something based on what I thought either other people would do, or I kind of violated some instinct of mine. And that's not to say that you shouldn't like, you know, go and take other people's advice. Like I don't know everything, like, you know, and I certainly knew even less starting out than I do now. But like you usually, like I think instincts are really powerful, right? Like in a sense, your instinct is like your own LLM that's been trained on like a massive amount of data that you can't even put your finger on. And like when you feel a spidey sense that like, oh, like I feel weird about doing this, but I'm going to do it anyways. Like that's when usually like the bigger mistakes have happened. So, you know, you have to trust your instincts. That's how you got you know, if you have product market fit, that's how you got your company and product off the ground in the first place. And just continue to trust those instincts at every phase of building your business.
Makes sense. I appreciate your taking the time, Howie. And for what it's worth, congrats on all the success you guys have had. I mean, you stuck with it for a long time, but also built a real company and a great product, right? Everybody I know around me uses it, myself included. So, you know, kudos for having a lot of discipline and integrity about how you went about it.
You know, you're one of the people who I've admired from afar for a very, very long time. It was exciting to get to spend some time together and have a fun conversation.
All right. Well, thanks, Howie. Good to see you.
All right. You too. See you, Mike.
Thanks for listening to the Pattern Breakers podcast. You can follow me on X at M2JR, and I encourage you to check out our newsletter at patternbreakers.substack.com. I'd love to have you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode. And if you like the show, I'd be grateful if you could leave us a review. Until our paths cross again, I hope you embrace the power of thinking and acting beyond the conventional boundaries. It's the people who dare to be different who truly make a difference.